State Affairs. We have a quorum. Madam Secretary, could you call roll?
Representative Wu?
Here.
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Price Tompkins?
Here.
Okay, everyone's here. Representative Johnson, welcome, and feel free to come up. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you, Martha Moore, and our moderator, Doug Bridges. So items on the agenda today, we're going to start with House Bill 139, and then have House Bill 132, followed by HJR 18 and HJR 6. All of these deal with the permanent fund in one way or another. So we're going to be taking public testimony on these at a later date, but a good opportunity to start hearing them. So I think, Representative Johnston, we can start with your bill. Okay. This is the first hearing in State Affairs for House Bill 139. And Mr. Irvine, go ahead and put yourself on the record and introduce the bill. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Robert Irvine.
Representative Johnston.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Christ Hopkins and Fields. Thanks for your willingness to hear this House Bill 139 today and kick off Permanent Fund Day with it. House Bill 139 grants an additional exemption from the procurement code to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation for the purposes of evaluating and managing investments. The types of investments that this exemption would apply to are often very profitable for our state. Under existing law, the corporation is exempt from the state's procurement code when it acquires income-producing assets or delegates its investments authority. However, they must comply with the procurement code when evaluating and managing the assets in which they invest. The change proposed in this bill will allow an expeditious timeline that better aligns with the pace of the markets in which the corporation works and will result in a more streamlined process. I'm available to answer questions, and I also know Executive Director Riddell is here to respond and also testify. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Yes, and this might be a question for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Thanks, Ms. Rodell and Ms. Swanson, for being here.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was wondering, in changing the procurement code, how many DUCs of these investments do you project doing? You know, obviously you were before doing some through the procurement process, and now you want to, you know, lift that. So I was wondering how many you were doing before.
For the record, Angela Rodell, CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund, through the chair, Representative Story, we would expect that this would affect about 8 to 10 decisions on an annual basis through that. I don't have a number as to how many of these we were doing before, because we really weren't doing this before because of the time constraints.
Sure. Follow-up. So I'm assuming that at some point there was a cost, and are we saving money by doing it this way?
Through the chair, Representative Story, we believe that there would be some cost savings, and that would be because we will be able to do more work ourselves rather than relying on other third parties to then get subject matter experts and look at this under existing contracts, have them do it. So that will generate a cost savings to the state and to the fund.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Thank you for answering my questions previously, but since our conversation
more questions have come up in my mind. And just for clarification in the committee, what is the current procurement code that you are under?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we are under the full state's procurement code. So we are, the only exemption that we have for that is for the investments themselves. So if we want to buy a bond, for example, we don't have to go through the state procurement to find a bond or a fiduciary, like a manager. Like if we wanted to hire Lazard to manage money, we don't have to go through a procurement for that. But those are the only things that are currently exempt. Otherwise, everything we do is under the procurement code.
Follow up. And what's the length of time on that current procurement?
Through the chair, it runs roughly 50 to 60 days. With all the appeal processes and things, notification requirements, when you go through that process.
Follow up. So this would be waiving that you could hire someone within a week, a few days?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Follow up. So I understand the need to be able to act quickly on some of these investment opportunities, but with the fund performing so well, and at least, you know, at first glance, it seems to be doing very well. You've done an excellent job in managing. Why the need for the change to improve upon something that's doing so well?
Through the chair, that's a really good question, and that speaks to the added benefit is the fee savings. So if we can streamline and create a process where we get more of the investment return because we now don't have to rely on third parties in an effort to avoid the procurement process, so that we can access some of these investments, we may be able to be much more opportunistic and timely and go directly and use staff resources rather than third-party fund resources for that purpose.
Follow up. One more question is a concern from the people's perspective is how would this prevent the good old boy type of hiring that a lot of people are suspicious of, especially when you're considering the investment of Alaska's greatest investment fund?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the trustees and the staff take their fiduciary responsibility very seriously. This is not an effort to give a good old boy to get a subject matter waiver on an investment. We take the investment itself extremely serious, and we want to make sure that it confirms or doesn't confirm the underlying thesis, which is why we're looking to have this exemption. This is not to steer business in any one direction to any one purpose. I think we've put in a lot of processes, and as you stated yourself, the fund's results demonstrate that the efficacy of that process.
Follow up. So for processes, you obviously have certain requirements for hiring these investors. Could you elaborate on that for the sake of the public to understand that this isn't just hiring anyone, that you're looking for people who fit certain qualifications and have gone through requirements of what you're looking for an investor?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Vance, so the process for when we hire managers and investment advisors is in the Board of Trustees investment policy. This is a living document that the board reviews on a regular basis. We try and look at it at least once a year, usually in the fall. And the purpose of that is to make sure that policy continues to reflect what we're doing and what the goals of the fund are. Within that is a manager selection rules and requirements. We are required to use the Board of Trustees general consultant to help us with that selection process. And there are ways to do alternative manager searches that are outlined. And really it is through a series of questionnaires and a process almost similar to a procurement process. It just doesn't have the time periods and the all the state contracting requirements and things like that in it.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux had a question.
I'm confused right now because I thought this was going bill was going to allow you to hire like third or not actually hire to retain third party people, and that that would be normally under the procurement code. But what I'm hearing, what I thought I heard from you now, is that what you do now? You go outside to another consulting firm and get that service. And what this bill does is allow you to hire the people directly?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, what we can do right now is we can hire a fiduciary. So this is somebody that has a specific responsibility to manage money for the fund. What this bill does is it expands that to include subject matter experts relevant to a specific investment idea. So if we want to directly invest and not use a fiduciary, but directly invest into an investment idea, and we want, but we don't have expertise, for example, in the biotech underlying, and we want a doctor, a medical person, they're not a fiduciary to the fund. And so they're required to go through the state, we are required to go through the state procurement process to find that professional service today. And we're asking for an exemption on that.
Just a follow up. So to hire people, actually, state employees, you use the procurement code? I thought that would be normally some sort of personnel code.
Through the chair, no. We do not use the procurement code to hire people. We're talking about contracts for subject matter experts. These are contracts that are let for professional services.
So, follow up. So, you're not going to be hiring them as actual employees. You're going to be retaining them as contractors. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, that is correct. We're hiring them to opine on a specific subject matter, whether it's engineering or biotech or tech, software, but whatever their field of expertise is, we're asking them to use that expertise to opine on the business validity of a potential investment.
And that I understand. I guess where I'm getting confused is the term hire. When I think of hire, I think of hiring an employee. You're actually talking about retaining an expert who would not be directly working for as an employee of the permanent fund, but would be a third-party contractor.
Through the chair, that is correct, and my apologies. I guess when I'm talking about people, I think hire versus retain or procure.
Okay, thank you. It was just confusing to me. Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Rodell, you spoke to me last time and said that currently the Permanent Fund Corporation can spend up to $100,000 without a procurement. So if you need, say, a doctor or someone in the medical biotech industry to consult with you before investing a large sum of money, you could right now pay them up to $100,000 for that opinion, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative Will. The state procurement code has a limited procurement exception for contracts under $100,000.
Follow up. So you said earlier six or eight times a year you might have the opportunity to maybe make a larger an investment where you need to contract someone. And over $100,000, is that pretty common for someone's opinion? I mean, you're not paying as a percentage of your investment or your return. This is strictly like hiring a lawyer or hiring a professional with an expert opinion, right?
Through the chair, that is correct, and it really depends on the amount of time they have to review all of the information and put that opinion and things like that together. And part of the challenge is with the shorter the time frame, usually the higher the cost. And so we're kind of working at cross purposes here because when the exemption is $100,000, odds are if you have 3 months for them to look at it, it may not cost that much because you've given them a lot more time and they can manage it with other work. When you're asking them to drop everything and do it within a week, which is sometimes what happens with us on some of these investments, that's when you get into a much higher cost proposition.
Okay. $100,000 a week. I guess that's acceptable.
through the chair, just to respond to that, it's unlike, you know, sometimes people have teams of people looking at this, and so while you may be procuring one person, you might, it in reality might be an entire group that's working on it for you.
I understand. I was follow up, please. You said earlier that if it's an investment, you don't need procurement, right? If you're buying $100 million worth of stock, or you don't, correct?
That is through the chair. That is correct.
What if follow up? What if it's a real estate investment, like you're buying a skyscraper? Same, you can still spend that money without the procurement.
That is correct.
You would just, if you want advice, and it costs $150,000 to get the opinion of the building is intact, that you'd need the procurement for.
Through the chair, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And has that kind of situation where you're buying a big, expensive skyscraper, which I imagine, I don't want to imagine how much they cost, but and then I don't know what it costs to get an opinion on buying, you know, a major skyscraper. I imagine it's engineering and so on. It's mm-hmm. extensive.
Through the chair, it can be. Okay. It can be, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess I might ask a question. Could you give an example of where doing this research has produced some significant returns for the corporation? And I recognize that would have been under a contracted structure in the past, and I'm assuming whoever you paid earned some percentage of those returns, so could you kind of give an example to show how if we were able to do this ourselves, we would actually earn more money with successful investments?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I think probably one of the most really large illustrative examples is with an investment that the Permanent Fund Board made, I want to say it was in 2012, 2013 timeframe. And they invested approximately $189 million into an opportunity called Juno Therapeutics. This is an opportunity that came directly to us from the group that was forming Juno Therapeutics. And it required it had a very fast track. And so we had to rely on a fund. We were unable to procure the medical experts we wanted to take a look at this directly ourselves in the time frame that we had to evaluate that investment. I think many of you know that this investment went as a IPO or initial public offering in 2017, I believe it was, and it has netted the permanent fund in excess of almost $1.8 billion. So it was extremely lucrative to the fund, and that's the type of thing that we want to make sure we can do without having to get a third party use one of our investment managers to do it for us.
Okay. Well, seeing no other questions at this, Representative Ledoux.
So when you do it through a fiduciary, that would be another investment manager?
Through the chair, that's correct.
You'd probably actually even be paying more for the service.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins, and then Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to interrogate the parlance, the nomenclature, to make sure that my understanding is accurate. When you say that presently we'd go through a third party to, say, evaluate an investment opportunity, if this bill passed, that would still be going through a third party, but a third party that's sort of more nimble, that's closer to the corporation, that can be procured faster. Would you be able to sort of sort out the difference between the two different types of third parties we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, it's a third party that's a non-fiduciary, so not an investment manager. Right now, we go through an investment manager.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the follow-up. And so right now, if we go through the investment manager, what does that look like? What does the status quo look like? Does the investment manager often in turn procure the services of the subject matter expert? I mean, we basically paying the investment manager as a middleman to get to the expertise that ultimately is at the end of the road.
Through the chair, that is correct. And they usually invest some of their own money then into it alongside of us. So
follow-up.
It's an opportunity for them as well.
So in effect, by passing this legislation, that would enable the corporation to cut middle people, middle entities, middle fund managers out of the equation to some extent.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Representative
Walton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was going to ask the same questions as Representative Christ Tompkins. But so basically, right now you're sort of using two middlemen, a fiduciary, and then they hire the subject matter. This would get rid of the fiduciary, so you can just directly get rid of the subcontractor, so to speak.
That is correct.
And the idea is simply to save money so you don't have to pay this other person, or is there something more? Because right now, current statute allows you to, you don't need procurement to hire a fiduciary, and that's because are you hiring them in the same sort of contract type way, or is it more of a, I guess I don't know much about what fiduciaries do exactly, so.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wool, when we do this through an investment manager, they're getting their fees, and so this really does allow us to start to cut some of the fees back on some of this, and be able to react quickly and not wait for, also not, you know, because that sometimes we have investment managers who also have a hard time meeting the time requirements.
And go ahead.
Oh, follow up. Just Mike, when you pay them is, and it probably works a lot of different ways, but mm-hmm. is it a percentage of the overall investment? It's not just, well, we charge, you know, $1,000 an hour. It's a
that through the chair, that is correct, Representative. Well, we pay a management fee that is a percentage of the investment, and then they usually also get a percentage of any profit sharing over and above hitting certain performance marks. So usually within these contracts, you have thresholds of performance that you have to hit, and then you get performance or profit sharing over and above that. And so they get a portion of that if we go through them to do these types of investments.
Let's follow up. So mm-hmm. you're not just hiring for this. You get into a sort of fiscal relationship with them for a while. It's not just a fee-for-service type thing. And you're wanting to eliminate some of that and just hire someone to do the job. When they're done, you pay them, make your investment, and move on.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and to me, the central insight here is we have more of the upside for those successful investments. Representative Ledoux had a follow-up.
So it sounds like this might save you not just a little bit of money, but a big chunk of change. Is that correct? I mean, give me an example, example, of somebody that you would have liked to have hired or retained directly if you had been able to do so without the procurement code, and what you would have likely paid that person, and then what you had to pay the fiduciary for this without revealing anything that you're not supposed to reveal.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't have exact numbers in front of me, so bear with me as I attempt to answer your question. But if you think about the previous example I gave on the Juno Therapeutics and the $2 billion,
is that a Juno company, by the way, a local Juno company?
Through the chair, no, they're in Seattle, but they are named Juno, J-U-N-O, after the relationship with Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. So there is a little bit of a nod to Alaska, a play on words, so to speak. But if you look at what we made on that, and that is all net to us. So the numbers I gave you are the numbers that went into the fund.
And I can't remember those right.
this stuff?
So we invested approximately $189 million. We sold the stock. It came out to about $2 billion. So if you take the $189 million that we paid and subtract it out, we made about $1.8 billion on that investment. That was ours. So if you had the fiduciary, this investment manager, going in with you, and they got a fee plus profit sharing, they would have gotten a fee close to $1 million, right? And then they would have gotten 20% usually is the standard. And so if our $2 billion was 80%, then their 20% would be another, I hate doing math in my head, you guys. Yeah. And it's millions and millions of, it's millions of dollars. Okay. So we are really happy with our return on that investment and the amount of money we made. The challenge for us is that you will not see decrements in our budget, and you won't see, if we calculate our budget based on percentages, it won't move because it's four decimal points out. Because sadly, while we think $1 million is a lot of money, and we do think $1 million is a lot of money, on $65 billion, it doesn't move the needle. And so that's the challenge we have when we start talking about fee savings. But it is important to us at the corporation. And we are always looking for ways that we can be create better results for the people of Alaska through our investment activity.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question to kind of piggyback on this line is, would it be unreasonable to ask the corporation to give a document of these savings? If this bill were to pass, could you come to us next year and say, because you've allowed us this flexibility, we saved approximately this much money? Is that possible?
Through the chair, I think that maybe, knowing it going in, it's much easier to sort of track that than trying to recapture it in hindsight. So I think it should be possible. I think it should be possible, Representative Vance. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you. I guess what you're alluding to, saving money, but also this gives you a lot more nimbleness and freedom and, control and flexibility, right? I mean, you now can act more quickly, and you don't have to wait on either the state or a fiduciary, right?
That through the chair, that's correct, Representative Wall.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here. This was the first hearing in House State Affairs. The amendment deadline for this bill is 5 p.m. Wednesday, May 1st. We're going to hold the bill today. Thanks, Representative Johnson and staff, for being here. And at this time, we're going to take a brief at ease for Representative Wool to cue up his PowerPoint. House Bill 132, Permanent Fund Deposits, Dividends, Earnings. Representative Wool and Mr. Grabman, do y'all want to present your bill? This is the first hearing in House State Affairs. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the illustrious State Affairs Committee. My name is Adam Wall, representing District 5 in Fairbanks, and with me is Nathaniel Grabman, my staffer. We have a bill to present here, and I will let Mr. Grabman start us off and take it from there.
Go ahead. Okay. All right. Co-chairs Fields and Christ Hopkins, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present on HB 132. For the record, my name is Nathaniel Grabman, staff to Representative Wool. All right. Since 1982, Alaskans have enjoyed an annual dividend derived from the earnings of the permanent fund. Oil-derived wealth accounts for the vast majority of the permanent fund corpus and earnings reserve. HB 132 aims to maintain these annual dividend checks for Alaska residents while ensuring that a statutory formula exists to calculate these payments regardless of external fiscal constraints. Historically, the PFDs have been based on a five-year rolling average of permanent fund earnings. Gubernatorial vetoes and variable legislative appropriation have reduced the amount of the PFD from its statutory value in each of the last 3 years. Barring statutory change, it appears likely that the value of the PFD will continue to be debated annually by the legislature, with the proportion of the percentage of market value, POMV, allocated to government services and the PFD constantly in flux. If enacted, HB 132 would accomplish several things. It would stabilize funding for government services by leaving the POMV untouched. It would reduce the need for a recurring argument regarding the amount of the dividend. And it would link the dividend directly to oil revenues. This would have the effect of increased dividends in high revenue years would help to offset the negative effects to residents of those high oil prices, such as higher fuel, utility, travel, and shipping prices. And as you'll see in one of our slides later, there's not a strong correlation between oil revenue in a given year and the historic PFD. If anything, they're inversely correlated. The general trend has been that when oil goes up, the PFD goes down, and vice versa. With the passage of SB 26 last year, a POMV draw now exists in state law. The proportion of the POMV which will be devoted to the PFD this year has already been the source of much discussion in both bodies of the legislature, and such discussions appear likely to continue on an annual basis moving forward. Although the principle of the permanent fund is primarily derived from oil wealth, the performance of the earnings reserve and, by extension, the value of the PFD have arguably tracked more closely with stock market fluctuations than with the price or production of oil. In the same way that taxpayers are more likely to pay attention to government spending than non-taxpayers, tying the dividend directly to Alaska's oil revenue will ensure that residents remain informed and engaged with respect to the state's oil prices, production, and policies. After that, I'm now prepared to walk through the sectional analysis on HB 132. We also have the short PowerPoint afterwards.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thank you, Nathaniel. I don't know if there's questions at this point, but I think we should go through the slideshow, and it's very short and might give some graphic illustrations that will help people understand what we're doing. And
I was just getting absorbed in this, so yes, please.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Right. Okay, we have moving, actual kind of moving pictures too. So, go ahead. No, we'll do the sectional later one.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so here we go. What does HB 132 accomplish? As I mentioned, there's kind of three things that we've talked about. It should stabilize government funding by dedicating the POMV draw to state services. It would link the dividend directly to oil revenues in a way that it's not currently. And it would reduce the need for these recurring legislative battles over what the PFD will be in a given year.
Jump in there real quick. The other thing we want to accomplish is that, as we all know and was mentioned earlier, we've been sort of breaking the statutory law in how we pay out the PFD the last several years. The formula statutorily says one thing, and we've been doing something else. So this bill will also eliminate the old statute so that we won't be breaking the law, and we'll set up a new statute which will be more easily followed. And the battle that Nathaniel is referring to is the battle over how much we pay, which never used to happen because statutorily the formula was there and we followed it. But since revenue has gone way down and the state is having a fiscal realignment, this will try to eliminate that conflict annually.
Representative Shaw.
Through the chair, so will this give us the flexibility to utilize the POMV as needed, separating government services and the dividend?
Representative Shaw, through the chair, what this bill will do will leave the POMV, the percentage of market value draw from the permanent fund, the 5% or currently 5.25%, that will go directly in full to the general fund. So it won't, no portion of that will be sort of siphoned off for PFD checks, which has been done. Well, I guess last year we didn't have 26 enacted, so The POMV will go directly to the general fund in full.
Representative Ledoux.
So, since the legislature has seen fit to not follow the law with respect to the current statute, what makes you think that that it would be, or we would be, any better when it comes to following the formula that you've set out?
Representative Dew, thank you for that question, and through the chair. Well, I think we stopped as a legislature, and well, it started when the governor vetoed the PFD amount in the budget and vetoed half of it. And then the following 2 years, the legislature also appropriated less than the statutory formula. And I think that was because we just couldn't afford it. And when you have a right now a $3,000 PFD by statute, which would be almost $2 billion, $1.9 billion, I think, is that amount. And if you're bringing in, say, $5 billion in total revenue between oil and POMV, and two of it is going out to permanent fund checks, many people are questioning, is that the best way to spend the limited revenue that we have? Now, this bill will draw money off of oil revenue. So if oil revenue is low, then the amount for the PFD will be lower. And if the oil revenue is high, the amount of PFD will be higher. And when revenue is low, basically, this links revenue to PFD, where right now our PFD could be really high, even though we're not bringing in that much money as a state. And I think that's the problem we're in right now. The PFD formula statutorily is pretty high, and our revenue to the state is not very high.
I see there are more questions, but if people are okay, I might suggest we just go through the PowerPoint a little bit more, because I think some of these hypotheticals are going to answer some questions. Is that okay, Representative Vance? Okay. Thanks.
All right. Nathaniel Grabman, back on. All right, so this slide is a generalized view of kind of the current situation. We have roughly two kind of types of oil. We have leases that predate 1980 and those that start in 1980. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but if you go to AS3713010A, you can get the details on that. So, at present, 25% of leases, royalties, royalty sales, bonuses, net profit shares, and federal mineral revenue from the old oil goes to the corpus. And on the new oil, it's 50% of those. I'll point out that the state constitution, Article 9, Section 15, states that it has to be at least 25% of this money going to the corpus. The remainder of that money, including all of the production tax, currently goes and flows into the general fund. Once the money hits the corpus, it gets invested. The investment earnings eventually go into the earnings reserve. There should be inflation proofing statutorily. And then after that, we now have a POMV draw thanks to last year's passed SB 26. That POMV draw goes to the general fund, and we then have a long, bruising, drawn-out argument discussion to figure out what the PFD is going to be. And then the next slide, under HB 32, we've changed it so that we now no longer have this distinction between old oil and new oil. We have 25% of those six categories. That value goes into the corpus. The same thing happens as before within the permanent fund. Investments continue as before. Inflation proofing continues. We continue to have a POMV draw from the earnings reserve to the general fund. Then the question becomes, what about the other 75% of those six categories from all the oil? Under this bill, 33% of leases, royalties, royalty sales, bonuses, net profit shares, federal mineral revenue, and production tax, or the amount needed to have an $1,800 dividend, will go to the general fund, where it will then be appropriated to the dividend fund and paid out as dividends. That leaves, if we don't have enough revenue to produce an $1,800 dividend, that leaves 42% unaccounted for thus far, and that money would go into the general fund, along with 67% of the production tax. So that's generalized how it would look under this bill. Moving forward, this is a chart of what the actual PFD has been compared to what it would be under if HB 132 had existed. You can see that in many spots the slope of from year to year between if you compare the actual PFD with what it would look like under HB 132, they are going in opposite directions. And interesting to note that it seems like the value of the amount of oil money we get from is not necessarily in tune with the direction of the PFD historically. This next one, if we were to not have this statutory cap, it wouldn't matter most years under HB 132. But if we remove the cap, there are times when we have massive disparities between what we have had and what would happen. For example, we have almost $5,000 dividends in some years when oil revenue spiked. That cap would allow us to put more money away in funds such as the CBR or others for state savings into the future. This next slide is a comparison of different proposed POMV splits as well as the statutory PFD. The POMV splits came from Ledge Finance recently. The statutory PFD came from OMB. As you can see, there's some wide disparity here, and we can come back to this in a little bit if you want. This last one is about this next one's about fiscal year 2020, and this chart shows you what the dividend under HB 132 would look like at different per barrel oil costs. We use the official production projections and then just took a linear extrapolation of 90%, 95%, 105%, 110% to kind of show what that would be. The top part of this chart is above that $1,800 threshold, so something to keep in mind. And any questions?
Okay. Representative Vance, I know, was in line for a question. Then we'll go back to you, Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I do have a lot of questions, being as I will recognize that we have very different views on this, but I'm going to try to remain respectful that you are not the full legislature that is responsible for not obeying the – not following the statutory formula. So I will say that ahead of time. So I do have some questions on the proposal and just comparing your different charts. You say that the permanent fund will be tied directly to oil, and right away this seems to be counter to the intent of the permanent fund from its inception. The intent of the permanent fund was to take a non-renewable resource and turn it into a renewable one to offset when our economy was low, largely due to oil prices. And that would allow for a cushion in Alaska's economy when oil prices were low, the permanent fund was high, and would help kind of balance out our economy. But with your proposal, that brings the permanent fund to follow the oil so that when our economy, when the state funds are low, our permanent fund will be low, and that seems like that will hurt our economy even more. What is your thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the permanent fund was created, you're correct. So when the finite resource of oil ran down, we would have a vast fund from which we could live off of, so to speak. And we will still do that. And we have the permanent fund, and we're taking a structured draw off it as of last year, or as of this year. And so that 5% draw we are guaranteeing that we don't take any more than that, and that 5% draw under this bill will go directly to government services. So the state of Alaska will actually be in pretty good hands in that it'll have a regular salary, retirement, whatever you want to call it, of steady money always coming in that won't be chipped away at year after year, where people say, well, what percentage of the POMV should we give to permanent fund checks this year? 25, 35, 55? I don't know. And I know other committees are talking, having this very discussion about what percentage. So the permanent fund will stay intact and in some ways will stay more robust because no one will be trying to sort of chip away at that 5% POMV. The permanent fund dividend, which I think at the original intent of the permanent fund, the dividend wasn't necessarily part of that original conversation. And I think it has morphed from what its original intent was. I think its intent was to give people a dividend off the oil wealth so that people would keep an eye on the investments and make sure, you know, the state wasn't spending a bunch of money willy-nilly. But it has become large. I don't think anyone envisioned the fund when it first started, and we have a chart that shows the initial, did you bring the chart of the initial value of the fund? When it started was in the hundreds of millions, I believe, and it was invested in sort of blue chip stocks with a very low return. I mean, the first permanent fund check was $300. The first one was $1,000, but it was for 3 years because of a lawsuit. So it was really about $300. It wasn't supposed to be a check that you got that you could, you know, plan your annual automobile purchase or snow machine purchase. It was a small amount, and it varied a lot from year to year. If you can put up a permanent, oh, it's not up anymore. Anyhow, I think the permanent fund has morphed from the dividend, not the fund. I think the permanent fund dividend has morphed from a annual sort of bonus check that could go from $300 to $1,100 into what has become now sort of a guaranteed income. And with this new structured draw and the size of the permanent fund, right now it's at $3,000. It's going to go to $4,000 pretty soon. And to me, that defies what the original intent of the dividend was. So I think the fund stays intact, and it won't be used. It'll be used to fund our government and services.
Follow-up. I'm going to respectfully disagree, but I'm not going to get into the philosophical discussion on how the money should be used right now. I'm going to keep it to the questions to directly on your charts here that you talk about the corpus. And currently, on your first chart, you have 25% of the pre-1980 leases and then 50% of the new leases going into the corpus. So that has helped the corpus continue to be very successful and very robust. But in your next slide, only 25% goes to the corpus. So wouldn't that hurt the corpus under your bill, because you would be putting 42% of leases directly into the general fund versus the corpus?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. Those numbers, 25 and 50 of old and new oil, are accurate, but I think the amalgam of those two, old and new oil, 25 and 50%, I think it ends up being around 31%, is really what we're getting now, is 31%. So it's 25% of old oil, 50% of new oil, but combined, it ends up being 31. So we went from 31 down to 25. So a little bit less is going to the corpus. You are correct. I don't know.
Follow
what
up?
Was the rest part of your question?
and
by the way, I just want to thank the chairs of the committee for hearing this bill, because I do know that this is not a cookie cutter or standard version of how we've been looking at the PFD lately, and people are trying to figure it out because we just started this POMV program, and we're trying to figure out how we can balance POMV, PFD, and that kind of stuff. So,
I was planning on moving it today. I'm surprised there's some questions.
You're messing with me, aren't you? I'm playing very nice. I just one more follow-up.
Yeah.
I just want to understand this bill. would you give me a motivation as to why we should accept this proposal? Because in my eyes, it seems like the POMV portion for government is being protected. You're reducing the amount that's going into the corpus, which doesn't a smaller amount is going into the corpus, less money is going into the economy, and you're based upon the charts here, they're the PFD that you are proposing would be just as static and it would be fluctuating just as much as what we have now. So where's the motivation to support this?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance. Actually, this model, the PFD check, would fluctuate more than it is right now, because with the $64 billion permanent fund invested in Wall Street and real estate and what have you, it does fairly well. It's produced, I think, 8% return over since its inception. So that to me is pretty steady money. And however we come up with a formula of statutory recognition or POMV percentage, it's going to be a steady check. My proposal is more of a fluctuating one, depending on the price and production of oil. And I think that as a PFD check goes, I think some variability and volatility is okay. And that I'd rather the state get steady money and the citizens get variable money, depending how the market is, the oil, our number one resource, is going. There'll also be, you know, maybe more incentive to produce more oil, maybe to produce natural gas. These things will make the amount of the PFD check go up. And if someday, let's say we don't have oil, let's say oil dries up and people decide they don't want to burn oil, if we are relying on a POMV draw to pay the PFD check without the oil revenue coming in, we're really going to have a problem. So this says, if there's no more oil revenue, let's say it goes to zero, we're not committed to giving everyone a $3,000 check in perpetuity, or a $4,000 check, or that $3,000 check, even with our even as a percentage of POMV, is going to continually go up for quite a while. So I just don't want to be locked into paying a large check when oil revenue could go down in the future. We don't know.
Okay, so we've got we have three pretty different proposals on the PFD that we're hearing today. I want to go to I'm guessing Representative Ledoux might have a question or two about this bill, and then maybe after.
Well, I probably made up my mind about it anyway, but
okay, or maybe any questions.
But I do have one question. I just want to clarify. So this puts a cap on the dividend, but no floor on the dividend. Am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you are correct. The cap is certainly could be raised or lowered. You could add a floor. I mean, it's open for interpretation. But like I say, if oil goes to $15 a barrel and production goes to 250,000 barrels a day, we're going to have a hard time keeping the lights on in certain areas. So to put a floor on a check, I mean, in a way, this dividend more reflects, say, the dividend check you'd get if you had stock in Ford Motor Company. If they have a good year, you get a good dividend check. If they lost money that year, you don't get a good dividend check. And this is more tied to year-to-year performance of our number one resource.
Thanks.
Representative Vance has one more question on this bill, and then I think I'm going to suggest that we go to the next bill, and then this is just the first hearing on all these, and we can come back to them. So Representative Vance.
I have one more question, and this is more of a rhetorical question, and it's one that I think a lot of Alaskans will ask. And it's something that I reflect upon personally as well, even more now that I'm in office. And it is, who do you represent, the state or the people? Again, a rhetorical question.
I'll try to answer that to the best of my abilities. Representative Vance, through the chair, I represent the people in the state, and I think the state and the people of Alaska are inextricably entwined. And I think if we have a good state system and supports the people, that's a good thing, and then the people will support the state. How's that? But I know this is going to this is a different approach for sure, and it's basically looking at just the previous administration put forth a PFD proposal with all kinds of squares and arrows, and a lot of it was complicated. But there was a component of that PFD check that was dependent on oil, and I always thought, as you may remember, when we had a lot of oil revenue some years ago. And then Governor Palin gave out a kind of bonus check, a little, because oil was making so much money for the state. I don't know what year that was on our charts here, but probably 2008 or thereabout, just before the. Anyhow, that year, this formula would have produced a $5,500 PFD check, which we didn't get, but we did get a bonus check of $1,200, and that was really an energy check, because a lot of people in certain parts of the state especially are paying a lot for heating oil, not so much in the Anchorage area, but definitely in the Fairbanks and rural Alaska. And so when oil was high, it was good for the state but bad for the people that were buying heating oil. So, and I thought that's a good link. So when oil's high, the state benefits, but the people don't. And I saw someone recently at an event in Fairbanks who was in the oil industry and was getting really excited when oil prices were starting to go up recently. And I said, well, that's great for the industry and it's good for the state coffers, but what about the school teacher? She gets no benefit from that except a higher heating bill, costs more to fill her tank, and when she orders something, you know, and it gets shipped, that goes up too. So there's no benefit for the average citizen when oil prices go up. So this would give the average citizen a bonus check when oil prices are up that could offset some of the other expenses incurred with high oil. So it's really good for the people.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Woolen. Mr. Grabman, let's go to HJR 18 with Representative Christ Tompkins and Mr. McGowan, and we'll take a brief at ease to get that one queued up. HJR 18, and next up we have HJR 6, so seems like we're moving along nicely at about 30 minutes per bill, and I want to make sure we have time to get through all of them. So Representative Christ Tompkins and Mr. McGowan, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, sponsor of HJR 18. HJR 18 does two things. It effectively hardens the rules passed by the legislature in SB 26 for percent of market value management of the permanent fund at 5% per year, and makes that, by hardening it, puts it in the Constitution and prevents overdrawing the permanent fund, or sort of preempts a scenario in which extra billions of dollars are taken out of the permanent fund beyond what is sustainable. In other words, drawing down the real value of the fund. And the second thing HJR 18 does is it effectively rolls the earnings reserve account and the principal into one, as the earnings reserve account, or the function of the earnings reserve account, would be rendered obsolete if you have a percent of market value management structure.
Questions. I actually have a question. It seems like you're awfully concerned about the legislature drawing down our savings account. On what would that concern be based, Representative Christ Tompkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's born out of two things. First, as I think I've related earlier in this committee, I've seen the legislature spend down $14 billion or so since I was elected out of savings, because that was easier than cutting the operating budget and or passing taxes. Regardless of what you think, which of those two were the right thing, one of those two needed to happen, but neither happened because it was easier to spend down savings. I found that deeply frustrating. And I mean, I think speaks to the sort of, you know, political logic of where elected legislatures can sometimes find themselves. So having hard protections feels like an important and prudent measure to take. And the permanent fund isn't just a $14 to $15 billion savings account, as I witnessed get spend down. It is one of the largest assets a sovereign in the world has. I forget where it ranks in the list of sovereign wealth funds across the world, but it's certainly the largest in the United States, and it is a huge intergenerational asset for generations of Alaskans beyond mine, and I want to make sure it's there permanently.
Yeah, and I was, well, I'm a co-sponsor of this, so I have a vested interest, but I was interested in the long-term prospects of the permanent fund, so I asked my staff to draw up projections for the size of the fund based on different scenarios with POMV draws, percentage to government spending, and I was thinking about it in the context of my daughter, who's very young and could live, you know, to the end of the century. So that was the scenario I looked at. So anyway, anyone who's interested in looking at these numbers, I just found them fascinating. Do other people have questions for Representative Christ Hopkins? Representative Shaw.
I have one. Thank you. Through the chair. Representative Christ-Tompkins, you highlighted that we've spent down the permanent fund $14 billion since you've been elected.
Representative Shaw, through the chair, important distinction, not the permanent fund, but savings accounts.
Savings accounts.
So the SBR and the CBR, namely.
Okay. Again, my apologies. We've spent that account down $14 billion since you were elected. And you have been part of the process of spending that down. We now have to be prudent because there's a potential we could go broke in that savings account?
Representative Shaw, through the chair, and I mean, a couple of qualifiers. I am that $14 billion account, and Mr. Odell or Mr. Tangeman, others probably could give a more precise number because I wasn't as close to the budget process or those who've been in the building, but it's, you know, plus or minus a couple billion dollars. And so that was starting in 2013. And yes, so right now the statutory budget reserve, I think, has $1.7 billion or so. I'm going to be a little bit off. And we've effectively bottomed that out. Arguably, you could go a little bit lower in the SBR. That's not advisable. So yes, we're in the situation right now where, well, I mean, arguably that's what prompted the passage of SB 26 last year.
All right, thank you.
Representative Vance.
First, I want to say thank you for recognizing the need to protect the corpus of the fund. I think that's something that all of us, I would hope, can agree on, is that we want to protect that because that is producing for us and has really been a benefit to Alaskans, and we want it to remain in perpetuity. But I have some questions about this proposal, and I was wondering, is there an inflation proofing or a need to have inflation proofing in this bill?
Representative Vance, through the chair, it's a great question. Inflation proofing is effectively accounted for in a percent of market value structure, provided that the draw is sufficiently conservative. So the 5% draw that's in HGR 18 and is also baked into SB 26 starting, I think, FY 21, effectively accounts for inflation in looking at the average market value of the permanent fund in the first five of the preceding six fiscal years. If you went higher than that, then the real value of the fund would be eroded through time by inflation. But effectively, inflation proofing is accounted for in a percent of market value approach.
But is that in statutory?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I think I understand the question you're asking, and under percent of market value approach, it's basically a classical endowment. You've got a big pot of money, you're drawing a certain percentage off that pot of money every year, which is totally different than the situation we have right now, mm-hmm. which is we've got these two separate pots of money. One pot is static, the other constantly grows, and occasionally we shovel money from the pot that's growing over into I hope that metaphor works. And it's really important to account for inflation by shifting money from the earnings reserve account to the corpus on an annual basis if you want the corpus to not lose real value through time. Because we're simplifying the structure into basically one giant corpus, it's all the principal, and we're drawing an amount that accounts for inflation already.
It's built in.
It's built in.
Okay.
Or maybe put differently, at an 8% plus annual rate of return, if you're drawing 5%, that 3% is more than enough to protect against inflation.
Follow up. So while this protects the corpus in the Constitution, where's the dividend?
Representative Vance, through the chair, it's a good question. When it comes to the permanent fund and the Constitution right now in this building, I think there's sort of, there's a lot of discussion about should the dividend go in the Constitution. I've sponsored in the past a constitutional amendment very similar to Senator Stedman's that would put the dividend in the Constitution. I personally believe that's a good idea. I also recognize that there might not be the support in this building to do that. And that's fine, because as a baseline, I think something that everybody, regardless of their views on the dividend, can agree on is that we want to protect the permanent fund itself. So under HJR 18, or percent of market value approach to managing the permanent fund, the dividend basically becomes a decision that the legislature makes, similar to now. The legislature could continue appropriating money to the dividend. I know you believe in the full statutory formula. According to the full statutory formula, the draw every year under a 5% POMV approach would be more than sufficient to pay the $3,000-plus dividend if there were the political will in the legislature. I mean, right now, it seems that there might not be the votes to do that, that it's going to be more of a compromise, but there's enough money coming out of the 5% draw every year to pay the full dividend. In all likelihood, it's going to be less, because that's the legislators Alaskans are sending to Juneau are landing. So it becomes a decision for the legislature.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So in here, on page 1, line 15, each fiscal year, the legislature may appropriate from the permanent fund to the general fund an amount that is not more than the 5%. So this is may appropriate the POMV. So historically, in the past few years, the words may and the word appropriate have been fighting words. Can you speak to why you chose those two to be in this constitutional amendment?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I think your question is getting at why the words may appropriate, as opposed to say shall appropriate, are in there. And I think you'll be pleased to know the answer probably aligns with your ideological outlook, which is if, for instance, oil jumps to $140 a barrel and we have a huge amount of traditional petroleum revenue coming into the state treasury, and the amount that's spun off by the permanent fund via POMV isn't precious dollars the way it is right now, where we're really hurting for revenues otherwise, that might mean the legislature might only take 4.25% of the market value, even though it could take the full 5, because it doesn't need the full 5, and keep the rest in the fund to grow the fund faster and for the benefit of future generations of Alaskans. So the reason there's not the shall appropriate language is there may be scenarios, and I hope there are, in fact, that the legislature deems that it doesn't need to spend the full 5% out of the permanent fund.
Does anyone else have questions? Could we maybe trade off?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Ledoux.
So under this scenario, it takes 5% rather than the 5.25 that we're taking now. So doesn't that make it more likely that we will have even sharper reductions of services or a lower permanent fund dividend than is likely to happen this year?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, under HJR 18 or SB 26, we're looking at a 5% draw in either scenario. So in that sense, I mean, there's a lot of other variables about how tight or not tight the budget will be come FY 21. But yeah, when the draw is 5% instead of 5.25%, there will be, in all terms, all relative terms, less revenue from the permanent fund available. You know, who knows, maybe there's more petroleum revenue, maybe we have a broad-based tax, maybe the state's population has shrunk and there are less services, you know, there's all these other variables. But just putting tunnel vision onto that one question, yes, it will be marginally tighter than it is presently with 5.25.
Thank you.
And it is my goal to be done at 5 sharp because we have another hearing from Judiciary in this room afterward. Representative Vance, do you have more questions for on this bill?
Just real quick, if you're able to answer this, for the sake of the public watching, because what your bill does is combines the ERA, the Earnings Reserve Account, and the corpus together. Can you describe what we're using our Earnings Reserve Account for right now so that the public is kind of caught up on this conversation?
Yes, Representative Vance, through the chair. As presently structured, the ERA is the account where I realize this is jargon that I'm about to say, but realized and unrealized earnings from the fund are to deposit it into, and that's sort of the pot of money that the legislature scoops out of when it comes to historically exclusively to pay dividends and presently to pay dividends as well as a degree of public services. That's the earnings reserve account as it presently exists. But when everybody says or thinks of the permanent fund, they're effectively regarding this sort of amalgam of the earnings reserve account and the corpus together, and that as a whole is the permanent fund. And I think very few people realize that there's this subdivision that exists within the permanent fund.
One more follow-up on that. But the difference between accessing the money is clearly different. Would you address that so that everyone has a clear understanding between the two and the motivation between combining them?
Yes. Thank you, Rosa Vance. I think I see where you're going. There is a very important difference between the two funds in that the corpus is protected under the Alaska Constitution and cannot be accessed for appropriation, whereas the earnings reserve account is all the money in it, and I think it's getting close to $19 billion at this point, is available for appropriation by a simple majority vote of the legislature, 21 and 11, House and Senate, respectively. So that is a profound difference between the two. And I think it's also worth noting that this sort of two-account structure of the permanent fund is highly unusual relative to other sovereign wealth funds around the United States and really the world. There are very few other examples of this, but it's the structure that we have.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Rodell, did we miss anything on inflation proofing, or are we good? Okay. For the record, Ms. Rodell, with the head nod indicated, we're going on the inflation proofing discussion. So amendment deadline is 5 p.m. Wednesday for this bill. Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins and Mr. McGowan. And next, we're going to take a brief at ease, but next we'll go to HJR 6, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund and Dividend, which is a governor's bill, first hearing in House State Affairs. Back on the record in House State Affairs for HJR 6, governor's bill, and this is the first hearing in House State Affairs. So if the governor's representatives could put themselves on record and present the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields, member of the committee. My name is Bruce Tangeman, Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Yeah, my name is Bill Milks, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law.
So Mr. Co-Chair, I will give a brief opening on the bill, and then I'm going to turn it over to Bill to do the sectional analysis. Corey Mills, Assistant AG, is also with us, as is Mike Barnhill, Policy Director for OMB, so he'll be able to answer some of the policy questions. So thank you for inviting us to Permanent Fund Day. I've got most of my notes have already been hit on. Everybody did a very good job of walking through the issue, but it is clearly an important issue to the state. We spent several years debating the POMB structure. Again, that's a draw system that's been endowment that's been used worldwide. It was critical for the state to step into that area as well. I think it gives Wall Street a lot of confidence that we're moving in the right direction to correctly use our resources that we have. So that was a huge step. We didn't address the split portion, and now that's what all these different discussions are taking place right now. So we're having some very healthy discussions, certainly. Governor Dunleavy's HJR 6 would protect the people's right to determine the future of the permanent fund dividend. The permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend was never broken and worked exactly as planned for 34 years. Over those three decades, the PFD calculation and the amount paid to Alaskans was never questioned, regardless of the size of the check, until 2016, when the legislature appropriated the full dividend. The governor vetoed it by half, and then for 2017 and 2018, it was both sides were in agreement for a reduced dividend. Just a couple numbers for history. And this goes to Representative Wool's point, where it does, instead of right now we track the market, obviously, with a five-year rolling average. I think your bill proposes to track the price of oil, price and production of oil. I don't know if it would eliminate the volatility according to the chart, but it'd just be tied to something, a different commodity. But for instance, in 2012, we saw a dividend of $878. A lot of people forget about that. That was only 7 years ago. In 2013, it was only $900. But in 2015, we saw the biggest dividend ever, $2,072. So that shows the market correction that took place in 2008. It affected the following 5 years. It fell off in 2014 or 13 when it started to climb again. And then we saw a couple very robust market years, which got us to that 2072. So there is volatility, but I think the point was Alaskans never questioned it. They weren't pleased with an $878 dividend, but they understood what the calculation was. No politics whatsoever went into it. It is what it is. It was what it was. I think once political decisions were made on it, that's when it got people's attention, and that's where we are right now, I believe. So what the constitutional amendment would do, it would guarantee the PFD. PFDs would not be subject to appropriation. The amount necessary to pay the calculated PFD would simply be transferred to the permanent fund dividend, the payment fund, that would then be appropriate or distributed as the dividend. It would protect the permanent fund dividend. The PFDs could not be reduced by the legislature or the governor's veto. That's one of the bigger changes. Any changes to the statutory PFD formula would require a vote of the people. It's Alaska's PFD, and they should be entrusted with the future of any changes to the calculation. And this particular resolution is part of Governor Dunleavy's larger fiscal plan that works to ensure Alaskans are included when deciding the size and scope of their government. So those are the opening remarks for HGR 6. I will turn it over to Mr. Milks to do the sectional, and then if there's questions, we have some other folks in the audience to assist as well. Thank you, sir.
Bill Milks, Department of Law. As the commissioner just explained, he gave the highlights of the proposed amendment, explaining the sectional. It's a constitutional amendment, so it's obviously very important, but it's not a long document. When we look through it, first we have that you know, this will provide that there will be a dividend in the Alaska Constitution. That's not currently in the permanent fund amendment. As the commissioner explained, there is a statutory dividend program. It was followed for three decades, and it wasn't followed fully. There was a court case challenging that, and the Alaska Supreme Court said quite clearly, absent another constitutional amendment regarding the dividend will compete annually for legislative appropriations. So this amendment is straight on the dividend. It's following up on that decision. So Section 1 is sort of a technical piece. It's just providing that the current dividend, the current permanent fund amendment states that all income in, from the permanent fund will be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. Right now, the provided by law is the earnings reserve accounts where all the dividend income from the permanent fund goes. There'll be one simple change here, which will say, except as provided under B of this section. And then B of this section provides for the program that the commissioners described. It sets out that each year, a portion of the income from the fund will be transferred solely for a program of dividend payments. It then goes on to provide that no appropriation will be required. And then it sets as the initial dividend program the statutory dividend formula that's in law right now. Next, subsection C, though, addresses the fact, provides that that dividend program can be changed. It can be changed by the legislature. Any change will be subject to the approval of the voters. Section 3 is simply providing that for purposes of the dividend amendment, when it's on the ballot, the program will be the program in effect January 1, 2019. So the section was fairly simple. The amendment addresses specifically the dividend.
Are there questions for Mr. Milks or Commissioner Tangeman? Represent Price Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the administration have a perspective on the changes that have been made to the Senate companion legislation to this constitutional amendment?
I could just take 1 second to go back and look at the changes.
If I may, perhaps, yep. could you just summarize the changes sure. made on the Senate side?
Yes, the largest change was that the dividend program under the proposed amendment would include both the statutory formula for how you calculate the amount, that would have to, any change in that would be subject to approval by the voters, as well as the eligibility for the permanent fund. And in the other body, I believe in the Judiciary Committee, that the eligibility piece was removed. And the administration had no objection to that. So that's probably the largest change is now under the version that passed Senate Judiciary, we'd be focused on the dividend calculation in current statute. There was also another change that would provide for quarterly payments of the dividend rather than only an annual payment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the administration's position on that change? On the, to be clear, the quarterly disbursements.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike Barnhill, OMB Policy Director. So there's three basic changes here. And as Mr. Milk said, with respect to the first change, narrowing the scope of the amendment to exclude eligibility, that's fine. The second putting quarterly payments, or I even suggested considering monthly payments. The administration's concern, while we didn't express objection in the hearing, the concern with that is that feels kind of statutory, quite frankly, and something that we could do in statute versus put it in the Constitution. But we didn't voice objection to it in the committee. And then the final change was pretty significant, and that was rolling SJR 6, which is the administration's proposal with respect to a constitutional spending limit, putting the entirety of that into SJR 5, the permanent fund. And that, our preference, again, we didn't voice objection, but our preference is that they be considered separately. They're two pretty substantial policy proposals to amend the Constitution. So that's the administration's view on those changes.
I think Representative Ledoux and Representative Gantz have questions.
So I'm just curious whether the administration is at all concerned that the idea of quarterly payments, in addition to the fact that it feels that that probably is something that could be taken care of in statute, whether it's kind of more of a social engineering concept that the administration might oppose.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there are valid policy reasons to pay the permanent fund dividend on a more periodic basis, and those are as follows. First, the economists suggest to us that if it's paid on a periodic basis, more of the dividend will stay in state. It will have more impact on the economy of the state. It could generate jobs where an annual permanent fund dividend tends to be spent outside. And so there are reasons to consider doing that. And so I wouldn't say from a policy perspective we object to more periodic payments per se. It's just, where is the right place to deal with that? Constitution or statute?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I get to the questions, I think it might be valid to have Ms. Rodell's perspective on the quarterly payments. I think she's not here, but one of the reasons that I've heard from Clem Tillion is a big proponent of quarterly payments is because it would help the people who need the dividend, but also a good portion of the money would stay in the corpus and be able to create more earnings during that time frame. So it might be more profitable, but I would like her insight into that maybe for next time.
Okay, maybe Mr. Harris, we could just make a note of that, and that's a good point.
So questions for from the administration is, in talking about the constitutional amendments, and the Senate has proposed adding the appropriation limit, the spending cap, into their version of the bill. Could we have one without the other amendments, or do we need both?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the administration was fairly intentional in how it structured this in three separate vehicles so that the people would have the ability to vote each one up or down based on its individual merits. And so that necessarily implies that you can have one without the other. We're giving the people the opportunity to vote up or down on spending limit on a dividend that constitutionally will be appropriated or transferred, and on the taxpayers' bill of rights, which is the third appropriation resolution. And so, yes, the answer is yes. You can have any one of those without the other. The Dunleavy administration's perspective is we need to give the people the opportunity to vote on each of these.
Follow up. Does this constitutional amendment protect the corpus of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the existing constitutional construct around the permanent fund protects the corpus in the language that was adopted in 1976. It says the principles, the principles shall be only used for income-producing investments, implying that it cannot be appropriated.
Thank you.
Following up on that, but it doesn't protect the earning reserve account. So the legislature could still draw down the ERA, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yes. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You guys mentioned the statutory formula would be in the constitutional amendment, and if it were to be changed, it would have to be a vote of the people. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf. So the way this is structured is what's changed in the Constitution is that it guarantees the payment or the transfer of the funds pursuant to statute. And then it introduces a new piece of direct democracy into the Constitution that if the legislature changes the statutory formula, then the people automatically get an opportunity to vote on that. It does not enshrine a particular statutory approach to the permanent fund dividend calculation. So the legislature retains the right to change that whenever it wants. It just requires that the people vote on any changes that the legislature make.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux has a question.
So does it require that the legislature vote on any change, that the people vote on any changes that the legislature might make before the changes can go into effect?
Correct.
Okay, so that if the legislature wants to make any changes, it makes changes and then it puts it out to a vote of the people, and after, if the people accept the changes, then the next year that can go into effect.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, correct. In other words, what it does is it prepackages a referendum. So right now, under the Constitution, when the legislature passes any law, the people can go through a referendum process by gathering signatures and get it on the ballot. This makes the referendum automatic.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to Representative Price Thompson and then back to Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of discussion, again, especially in the other body, about a 50-50 split, I guess generally a 50-50 split of a draw under a POMV structure as a compromise, which is still a substantially larger dividend than has been paid the last couple of years, but also substantially less than what would occur under this amendment. Does the administration have a position on such a 50-50 of the draw compromise as discussed?
Can we just pause while I consult? Representative Christ Tompkins. So the position of the administration is we haven't taken a position pro or con on any new approach to the permanent fund dividend like a 50-50. We're certainly willing to engage in the discussion.
Thank you.
Representative Vance had more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a clarifying question. So if this bill were to be passed, it would not automatically become part of our Constitution. It would go to the people on the 2020 ballot first to see if they agreed to it, and then it would become part of the Constitution.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that's correct. And to be perfectly accurate, this isn't a bill, it's a resolution.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'd like to follow up on Representative Ledoux's question. Have y'all mapped out a timeline? I mean, this would substantially alter the budget process if the legislature found a need to change the statutory formula, since those changes would then have to be approved by voters. So have you all sort of mapped that out beyond the brief description that you just gave.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it would substantially change the budget. So the resolution as proposed is pretty clear about the timelines. A new calculation of the PFD would take effect in the fiscal year. It would be the first opportunity for the legislature to appropriate pursuant to the new formula would be in the fiscal year that follows the fiscal year in which the election takes place. So we vote in November. We go into the legislative session the following January. And then the legislature would appropriate for the following fiscal year pursuant to the constitutional amendment. So I think it just kind of naturally flows.
Not seeing additional. Okay, Representative Vanson.
I know. Thank you for humoring me with all these questions. But, hey, this is PFD day, and we're still on time. So, for the sake of working together, with both bodies and looking at what the Senate has proposed with adding the spending cap into this resolution, what if there was an agreement to add all three together? Is that that way it was on the ballot as the whole kit and caboodle, that the voters were going to approve an income tax, the dividend and a spending cap all in one? Is that workable, or would that create more problems?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, let me first acknowledge the perspective to try and make constitutional issues more simple for the people. I get why you might want to do that. But I think a lot of time and effort went into thinking carefully what was the best way to present what can be some fairly complicated issues to the people. And the decision was made to use three separate vehicles that really do address three separate subjects. One is giving the people a voice in how the permanent fund dividend is calculated in any legislative decision to change that. So that really is a discrete issue that stands on its own. The other two is giving the people a voice in any tax changes or increases to taxes. And then finally giving the people a voice in amending the Constitution to limit spending. And as I articulate each of those separately, I think you can see that they really are separate, discrete issues. They do all fall within one article of the Alaska Constitution. That's Article 9. And so it does relate generally to fiscal issues. If they were all rolled in, we think we could defend it. You've probably heard or read the concerns about revision versus amendment. We think we could probably defend it against that argument. But really, the intention of the administration is to give the people the ability to vote each one up or down separately.
Thanks. Do you want to follow up, or Representative Ledoux had a question, and then Representative Wohl?
So this is actually a question with respect to the amendment. I can't remember which number it is. It might be 4, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. Am I reading that correctly, that would allow, in addition to if the legislature were to pass a tax, that the people would have to vote to approve that tax, but also that, for example, if the people were to pass through an initiative process, just for an example, an oil tax, that the legislature would have to approve what the people just voted on? Do I read that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you do read that correctly. And so again, a moment ago I mentioned how this particular HR 5 sort of prepackages a referendum or an initiative. In the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which is SJR 4 or 5?
4.
Okay. It's the same thing. We're prepackaged. So if the legislature passes a new tax or increases the rate of a tax, it prepackages the people's a referendum by the people. So it happens automatically. And then coming back, if the people initiate a tax or increase the rate of tax, then the legislature has to approve that. Both of these mechanisms exist right now with one exception, one caveat, and that is when the people initiate a law, the legislature can't repeal that for 2 years. So we're shortening up that time frame in that resolution.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So I actually don't think a lot of the people who may be supporting what's called the taxpayer Bill of Rights realizes that that would impact the people's ability through the initiative process. The most likely tax, I think, to be approved through an initiative process would likely be oil taxes. And I don't think a lot of people realize that this would give the legislature a second bite at that. So I'm just putting it out there for the record.
And we've gone a bit astray in the discussion. I'm happy to continue engaged because it's kind of like a free hearing for us, but I'll respect the wishes of the chair.
I know that Representative Wool and Representative Christ Hopkins have questions, so let's go to those just to make sure we get them in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick. well, Mr. Barnhill, so you mentioned that the PFD, the tax, and the spending cap are kind of separate issues, but some of us, when we're sort of crafting a budget, definitely look at all three of those. We don't really have a substantial tax right now, but it's a revenue, and PFD is an expenditure, and the spending cap tells us how much we can spend. So when we're putting together a budget, all those things go into it, and if we want to say lower the PFD or raise a tax in order to, well, the tax would take a while to be enacted, but when we pass a budget, and because the last few years we've been straying from the statutory formula, obviously, all these things are intertwined to our final budget product. By separating, do you think that by separating things that are kind of entwined, do you think that could be a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, no.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a problem. I think we can count on the people to make their analyses on each issue separately. But to the extent there's like an emerging consensus within this committee to roll them all in to move it forward, we're probably not going to violently object to that.
Yeah, yeah. Follow up.
Sure.
That wasn't where I was going necessarily. But, I guess I also want to say for the record, it's you're almost introducing another branch of government in that you have the executive branch. I mean, you have the House, you have the Senate, and now you have the people that will have to basically be involved. If we want to raise or lower something, we can do it, but then we have to get the approval or disapproval of a whole other body, which is going to take a year or more to and a lot of campaigning to try to educate people on what we want to do or undo. So we need another sort of person to sign off on pretty important stuff. Not a person, but population.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I mean, it's a fair comment. This very issue was discussed and debated at length in the Constitutional Convention, the extent to which we want to include a pretty vigorous element of direct democracy. And the convention did approve that. And we do have a very strong the people have a very strong access to legislation through the initiative and the referendum process. And what I would just suggest again to the committee, what the governor is proposing here is essentially taking that element of direct democracy that exists right now and that the people regularly access right now, and we're essentially prepackaging initiative/referendum with respect to the permanent fund dividend and with respect to new and increased rate of taxes. I would suggest to the committee that if the legislature were, as Representative Christ Tompkins indicated a moment ago, were to make a change to the permanent fund dividend calculation statute, say it's 50-50 or something else, that I think there's probably a relatively high likelihood that a referendum would be filed. And we would be there anyways. And I would suggest the same for a new tax or change, you know, consider an income tax. If the legislature were to pass and a personal income tax, I think we would get that referendum anyways. So we're just prepackaging it, making it automatic, giving the people the opportunity on these very, very important issues, which the people care deeply about.
Let's go to Representative Price Tompkins, just to make sure we get on all the questions before 5.
And this is maybe more of a PSA, but for the committee's reference and also the administration's reference, I believe HJRs 5, 6, and 7 are scheduled on Tuesday, so stay tuned for Constitutional Amendment Day next week, so all this will be fair game.
And by that time, we'll get the numbers straightened out.
And I should have mentioned the amendment deadline for HJR 18 is actually Monday at 5 p.m., not Wednesday at 5 p.m. The amendment deadline for HB 132 is Wednesday at 5 p.m., and the amendment deadline on this HJR is Wednesday, and that's Wednesday, May 1st at 5 p.m., so... hope that clarifies things. I guess I have a question. Was it intentional or was it an accident to require legislative approval of voter-approved initiatives? For example, a voter initiative to spend less money on per-barrel tax credits to oil companies?
Mr. Chair, compound question. So let me just take the question I thought you were asking first, and that is, was it an accident to require legislative approval over a voter-initiated new tax or increase to the rate of tax? No, that's absolutely what the point is. And just for the committee's information, we introduced it as a pocket passage. Yep, I'll let Bill talk.
We're now moving over to the tax amendment, right? So, as Mr. Barnhill, well, just to quickly answer the question, in the tax amendment, if the voters by initiative pass a new tax or increase the rate of tax, then the legislature has the opportunity to reject that. When it was originally introduced, it presented the default as if the legislature does nothing, then the new tax was rejected, and in the Senate Judiciary, that was changed, and the administration was fine with that. So now that default has been changed in that version of the bill on the tax amendment. So if the voters pass a tax, the legislature has the opportunity to